This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Team Checker or Team Mike on Controlled Choice? Where do you fall?
Team Checker.
Oh, see, when Mike got in the office, we all agree.
Yes.
The question is, in August, will we all be moving down to the seventh floor?
I know. We'll see. Traitors we are.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is Michelle Gininger of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, someone who could one day give his very own State of the Union speech, Michael Brickman.
I don't know about that. Too many skeletons there.
Well, you were born a U.S. citizen. Yes.
Check.
Okay. Then there's a possibility. You never know what'll come.
I might someday meet the minimum qualifications for being president, but I think there's a few more steps there.
And the question is, are you stupid enough to ever want to be president?
No.
All right. No. Well, maybe not. But, you know, you could give a speech somewhere someday.
Common core. Done it once or twice.
All right, then you're halfway there.
I need people behind me, though, making faces while I'm talking. That's easier.
I don't know. Do you want, like, serious faces? Do you want people, you know, falling asleep in the background? There have been those pictures.
Muttering under their breath. I could go with a, what was that guy's name? The You Lie?
What was his name? Don't remind me. Okay, Pamela, don't mutter. Let's just start. Pardon the Gadfly.
On Wednesday morning, the Department of Education gave charter schools the option of using weighted lotteries without surrendering their shot at federal startup dollars. This had Mike jumping for joy, as he's argued for years that we should embrace a variety of strategies to make schools diverse. Checker Finn, however, deemed this nanny statism, and the two had a brawl on our flypaper blog. So, are you guys on Team Checker or Team Mike?
Brickman, are you going to declare your team or play smart politics and keep your mouth shut?
No, I declared my team and... We were emailing back and forth, and I think diversity is absolutely should be a goal of our education system, but to have forced choice, I don't know if that's really choice if it's forced, right?
So you're a team checker.
Team checker.
With the hashtag before.
Well, yeah, we're doing the hashtags and the emails, but then we realized that we probably need to explain to Checker what hashtags were. So just Team Checker, just normal English words.
Yeah, so I think I'm going to split hairs here. Mostly I'm on Team Checker, but I do like that the U.S. Department of Education will give schools that do want to do a weighted lottery the ability to get funding. So I don't go as far as Mike's Washington Post op-ed of saying the whole city should do this and these are how we should do enrollments in a city, but I'm okay with a charter school saying, you know what, this is our priority and we're going to do a weighted lottery for English language learner students or whatever it may be, and I'm okay with that. So I'm Team Checker with an asterisk.
Agree with you there.
Yes. All right, question number two.
Senator Lamar Alexander filed legislation that would consolidate some 80 federal education programs into one giant funding stream in order to create an optional school choice program for states. Does this have a shot?
Nope.
Yeah, I mean, no, it doesn't. I mean, sorry. Look at the numbers.
So, yeah, I wrote about this yesterday or the day before and saw these two senators speak, Senator Alexander, then also Senator Scott, who has a proposal on school choice. And they're great ideas. They're well-written bills and hopefully will make a difference in putting a marker out there to show where the Republican Party stands. You know, you had Mitt Romney, who was talking about some of these school choice proposals, but they were more or less mandatory for states. And so you have this conflict between conservatives wanting to be pro-school choice, but also wanting to respect the 10th Amendment. So I think this does both and does it in a pretty effective way. Republicans take the Senate and you never know.
Okay, that's just not going to happen. But going on, I think that there are some exciting things on the bill. I definitely like Senator Scott's bill, which is more of a slow rollout of vouchers. It's, you know, an expansion of the DC program for students and as well as military students who don't live close to a military school. But what Lamar Alexander's bill doesn't do is it doesn't require the state testing as our voucher kit that we released earlier this month requested that or suggested that states do. What do you say about that, Brickman?
Well, I think that's a state issue. You know, I think the accountability, every school choice program is different, and this allows every school choice program to be different at the state and even the local level. Colorado's voucher plan, for example. And I think states need to kind of figure out their own way of doing accountability, not just for public schools, but for the choice schools too.
But the one way to get Democrat support at the federal level, for example, with the DC SOAR program, was it had extremely high accountability standards. I mean, Dianne Feinstein, Mark Warner, and various other Democrats who went and supported the DC program, I'm going to guess a large part of that was because of accountability. Now, obviously, the numbers aren't there, but let's say the gap in the Senate closes and they can pick up five Democratic votes. I think it needs the high accountability. Of course, Reid will never let this hit the floor. Okay, third question.
Vergara versus California, the trial over California's teacher protection laws, has commenced. Plaintiffs have taken an equity tack, arguing that the state's teacher dismissal process, teacher tenure laws, and last hired, first fired policies put poor and minority kids at higher risk of receiving subpar instruction from their peers, which would be unconstitutional. Do they have a case?
I think they might have a case, but I don't think it matters. I mean, I think California is a really difficult state to try to get these policies changed, as we've seen for decades at this point in California. But even if the court case rules in the favor of ed reformers, I don't know that it will mean anything. I mean, there have been plenty of cases in California on various issues outside of education where, you know, they've said something is unconstitutional and then nothing changes. There's no police for the judiciary. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where this case will actually end up. I think that's a good point that even if they win, they might not actually win. And there's also the concern about setting a precedent of, do we really want to do education reform through the courts? I think having sound legislation and making the case, even a state like California, where we have a really high bar, it's going to be really, really tough to overcome the California Teachers Union's, let's just say, extremely overwhelming power in that state when it comes to education reform. I don't know. I think you just got to keep pushing, and you know, maybe California is the last to reform its tenure policies and its teacher quality policies, but eventually they'll get there.
There was a great quote from a teacher union attorney, or an attorney representing the teachers union in this case, about how, you know, they're open for debate and would like to do this through the legislature. And I just thought, well, what have we been doing for the last decade? And through the teachers union power, every bill got shot down. So it was sort of just oh gosh, that's such a planted quote. That's so ridiculous. But I think it's an interesting test case. So I'd like to see what happens, and maybe it will work. And maybe it is something that ed reformers should pursue. I mean, we don't want to shut the door too early on it. So,
and if it works out and if it ends up benefiting kids, that's good stuff.
I think this is a wait and see case. Okay, that's all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Thank you, Pamela. Up next, it's Amber's Research Minute. Welcome to the show, Amber.
Thanks, Michelle.
So we were discussing earlier, Team Checker or Team Mike on controlled choice? Where do you fall?
Team Checker.
Oh, see, when Mike's not in the office, we all agree.
Yes.
The question is, in August, will we all be moving down to the seventh floor with Checker?
I know. We'll see. Traitors we are.
Well, now the real test is, Mike, listen to the podcast when he's not on it.
That
we won't
say
anything to
true,
him.
Right. Mom
we'll
is
out.
The word.
Well, Amber, what do we have today?
So we got a new study out called Learning That Lasts by Susanna Loeb and colleagues. I just love Susanna Loeb and Jim Wyckoff, and they did the study from Calder. So anyway, they look at whether math and ELA teachers differ and how they impact students' long-term knowledge, which is kind of a question we actually don't have answered yet. So so they study whether ELA and math teachers impact student performance in future years, not just one, and whether that impact bleeds over by impacting not just their own subject, but more generally, meaning in both subjects. They use New York City, about 700,000 third through eighth grade kids. They look at 2003 through 2012. Three key findings. One, a teacher's value added to ELA achievement has a crossover effect on long-term math performance. So if you have a high-quality ELA teacher, that impacts both your math and ELA performance in future years. Same is not true of math. They don't have too much impact on ELA performance in the long term. So, you know, this kind of makes sense. I mean, it's probably due to the nature of ELA, since we know that when you learn to read and think critically, that bleeds over, right, into every subject area, where math tends to be just very subject specific, and the test seems to be more aligned from year to year and build on itself. Second finding, teachers in schools serving disadvantaged kids have less persistence, meaning less enduring impact, than teachers with similar value-added scores. So that suggests that school-level curriculum and things like that actually make a difference and matter. Or maybe it's that teachers in these schools actually care more about teaching to the test. We just don't know. And number three, within subjects, teachers who attended a more competitive undergraduate college tend to foster long-term knowledge more so than teachers from less competitive institutions. So bottom line for me, like, value-added scores continue to matter, but as usual, it's much more nuanced. The discussion needs to be in terms of how we interpret them, because subject area, the test itself, the school type, the teacher background, all these things make a difference in how we think about those measures.
Very interesting. So is VAM a sham?
I'm not ready to go with VAM as a sham. I'm ready to go that it's much more complicated picture, and questions like this need to be answered, right? Like, are they effective over the long term? And, you know, how do these different subject areas impact one another? How does teacher background play into this? I mean, there's just so many questions here that haven't been answered. I think we feel like we've cracked the code with value added, and we just started doing this research, 5-7 years ago? So lots more questions to be asked. And I just thought they, you know, asked an interesting question and came up with a lot of information. I mean, this could have been like research 5 minutes, but you guys don't like it when I prattle on for that long.
Oh. So one other question though, does this idea that there's carryover from reading, but not from math or maybe other subjects, does that maybe lend credence to the folks who say you learn to read and then you use reading to learn?
I think so. I mean, I think we've often said, I mean, this goes back to the Reed Lyons stuff years ago, right? Where he said, you know, this is not really a problem with identifying special needs kids. In many cases, these kids just can't read and they're being misidentified. And I think, these studies lend some indirect credence to that notion that reading and ELA matters, and that it can impact all different areas of learning for kids.
And I think this is something that Dara has mentioned to me, you know, obviously former DC public school math teacher, and she would talk about how when her kids couldn't read, you know, they couldn't do math problems. So it makes a lot of sense that what they're learning in English class bleeds into other classes, even math, which, you know, you wouldn't think reading is as important as a lot of numbers, but it turns out you do need these passages. And I also have to say, is this another bell ringing for E.D. Hirsch and Core Knowledge?
Yeah. Mike's not here, so we have to say that.
Someone has to say it, right. And I'll be the one.
I mean, kids are more and more being asked to explain their answers, not only in writing, but verbally. You know, when you get an answer in math, you got to be able to explain it. So yeah, I mean, these skill sets sort of build upon each other. So makes sense.
So it sounds like a really interesting study. More questions need to be answered, so maybe more research to follow.
Yeah. I'll read. If Calder puts out a study, I'm always wanting to read it.
Well, there you go.
So.
Thank you, Amber. That's all the time we have this week. Till next week.
I'm Michael Brickman.
I'm Michelle Gininger at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.